This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome, everybody, to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I hope you're having a wonderful summer. We're back for what we'll call season four after our little bit of a summer break. And I'm happy to be joined today by Noah Ehrenstein for our kickoff episode of the season. Noah's got a very diverse background. He's done a little bit of everything, so there's a good chance you've run into him or one of his projects in some capacity. He's been a cook, a writer, a lawyer, a restaurant owner, an event planner. He does it all. So he currently has the owner of El Atoradero, which is in Brooklyn. They've also got a taqueria in Gowanus. They just opened up a Mezcal bar. He's the co-founder of Real Cheap Eats, which is a website to seek out the best food under $10 in New York. And he's also written for a lot of publications, Savour, Thrillist, and many others. Noah, we're going to talk a lot about everything that you're up to and everything you've done in the past. Welcome to the program.
I'm so honored to be the season premiere guest. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So I want to start off by not right at the beginning, but I want to talk about when you were a lawyer. I want to talk about you being in New York City and being a lawyer. How are you balancing your day job and then your love for food and the things that you're sort of doing either at night or on the side or maybe during the day while you're being a lawyer?
So I'm still technically a lawyer. I'm still practicing.
Okay.
Much less than before I opened a restaurant. Yeah, it was very cool how I got into it. I kind of came in through like the back door. I started as I honestly just like started a food blog in 2010, and from there started meeting people. And at that time, I was much less busy as a lawyer than I became. Then you know, it was just like one of the rare outlets I had. You know, for a time I was working 70, 80 hours a week as a lawyer.
What kind of law?
A lot of like first I was a litigator, like commercial litigation. My family is actually all criminal defense attorneys in Cincinnati, so I had that background too. I worked for the Innocence Project, which they're the major organization when you think of people who are exonerating innocent people via DNA testing. So I did some work for them, and I did a little criminal defense work, and then found myself in real estate litigation. And which kind of became a good base of knowledge for helping restaurants and working with restaurants and small food businesses. Once I started, I did a smorgasbord stall in 2013, and that was kind of, you know, I knew a lot of food writers before then, but then I kind of knew people in the industry after that, and people really had a lot of questions about the law, about how, you know, about, you know, there's so many areas in food where you're bumping up against, you know, litigation or even just contracts or anything. So yeah, I kind of found myself in this position where I was able to provide a lot of people with a lot of help.
It's cool because they're obviously looking to you for advice and actual counsel. And you're saying, well, I'm starting a food business. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the tricks of the trade? How do I be efficient in my smorgasbord stall? So for people that don't know that are listening, if anyone in the world doesn't know what smorgasbord is, for some reason, it is a outdoor food festival that's now popping up everywhere across the United States. But you were doing the Williamsburg one.
Yeah, I did the Williamsburg one.
In 2013.
Yeah,
and
it was short-lived.
What was the name of your...
It was
spot.
Called Scharf and Zoyer. I think it was kind of an inside joke almost. We were making global Jewish sandwiches, what we call them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a lot of what you're doing now, but a lot better than what I could do. But yeah, we kind of were just taking ideas from different Jewish cuisines all over the world and kind of mashing them up.
So what's like an example of a Scharfenzoyer sandwich that you were doing?
So the stuff, the one that was really close to my heart was a tuna salad sandwich on an everything croissant that Bread's Bakery had made for us, especially. And it had, you know, potato chips in it too. So it had like this crunchy element. One of like the secrets to the tuna salad was adding toasted panko. So it kind of stretched the tuna a little bit and kind of gave it like a nicer matte texture. The thing that got really popular, which was always like the stupid thing that was on the menu, was this we were calling it a kugel double down, where it was basically a fried piece of kugel used as bread. So it was kind of a predecessor to like the ramen burger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember being like, you know, really kind of pissed off when like the ramen burger got big. I was like, this is the same concept, and
right.
nobody cares.
So it was like two slices of kugel with a hamburger in the middle.
Not a hamburger. So I didn't do a burger. Okay. I guess I did cook a burger at home once with it. I didn't ever sell that. Uh-huh. We did like was it the Hungarian pepper ajvar, Ivar?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it was like, but we did a savory one which had fried chicken skin.
Mm-hmm.
And something, I can't even remember what else was in it. And then we did a sweet one that was like an apple compote and some ricotta cheese. It was really nice, but it was like kind of a stupid gimmick that
sounds good. Yeah, I mean,
it was good.
Those definitely sound like, I totally understand what you were hoping mm-hmm. to achieve with that. What was the rationale for doing Smorgasbord? Were you like, I'm bored, I want to give this a shot? Were you trying to launch Scharfenzoyer to be a actual brick and mortar restaurant?
No. I mean, in retrospect, I was like, what was I thinking? You know, it cost a lot of money and made zero money. We had my partner, who now is a baker in Richmond, Virginia. You know, he and I had this idea to kind of for Scharfenzoyer that we had done in like South Street Seaport, this like little market, and it had done well. And we're like, you know, Smorgasburg's the next step, let's do it. And in the meantime, he was like, I'm moving to Richmond. So I was kind of on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I presented by myself, and it went over way better than I expected. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're in Smorgasburg. And I'm like, oh, okay, let's do this.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it, you know. And now, yeah, I now like it's funny because a lot of people will come to me now because they're like, oh, you did Smorgasburg, I'm about to do it. Like, I'm going to apply. Like, what should I do? Like, is it a good idea? And I can give good advice, you know, now looking back on it. But when I was in it, I was like, what am I doing? Like, I don't really, I'm working all, you know, and it's, but, you know, if you think of it in terms of like, you know, a business proposition, I basically spent all week stressing and thinking about one day of actual service, you know, 8 hours where it could rain and could wash me out for the whole week. I was like, this is a terrible business idea.
It's not the same at all as being in a restaurant, because you've got a very short window to capitalize on your sales, and then your leftovers, your unsold goods,
garbage.
Where do you put them?
Like, I ate a lot of leftovers. I fed a lot of people.
You're like all I have 40 pieces of kugel come to my apartment totally. On Sunday. It rained today, totally. And I'm screwed.
I mentioned those everything bagel croissants. I had a lot of savory bread pudding for about 6 months. That was all I ate. I would just like any of the leftover croissants would just go into a bread pudding. And I just eat that like two meals a day.
It's kind of wild that you did Smorgasbord and you weren't deterred by the experience. So you did Smorgasbord and then you continued to pursue this restaurant dream. What was the vision when you stopped doing Smorgasbord for a restaurant, and did that vision become El Atordero, or did it change many times?
So it actually changed a bunch. So, you know, I stopped doing Smorgasbord, I think, late summer. I basically just ran out of money and it was like, this is not really going anywhere. I don't really have a plan for it. I took a step back and I started getting a few opportunities to do some single event pop-ups. I was like, this makes a lot more sense. I can sell tickets. The people, you know, I felt like at Smorgasbord I was having trouble kind of reaching the people I wanted to reach, because people go to Smorgasbord and they want to try a bunch of stuff. But, you know, they kind of, at the same time, it's like, oh, I want to try the ramen burger, I want to go get barbecue, I'm going to get wings. I don't necessarily want to eat a cool sandwich in the middle of summer. And at that time, I got hooked up with Tyson Ho, who owns Arrogant Swine just up the street. And he was looking for legal help. And at that time, I kind of was like, oh, I can you know, help restaurants. You know, and like I said, a lot of people are starting to come to me looking for legal advice. And I wanted, at that point, I was like, I want operational experience in restaurants. And Tyson needed legal help. I wanted operational experience. So it kind of just made a lot of sense for us to partner up. So that was the end of 2013, early 2014. And I helped him open Arrogant Swine.
And what is Arrogant Swine?
So Arrogant Swine is the only Carolina whole hog barbecue restaurant in New York City. And Tyson is this Chinese guy from Queens who, you know, has this affinity for whole hog barbecue and is, you know, one of the most passionate, you know, focused people I've ever met. And he just knew exactly what he wanted to do, but like didn't have, you know, needed some help that I could offer in a lot of areas, and it just worked. So we helped him open that. And after that opened, I was like, okay, this was fun. Let's try it again. And, you know, I was kind of took a step back again. I was, you know, representing some people and, you know, helping people out. I was doing a lot more events at the time. And this opportunity in the space in Prospect Heights came up where El Atoradero is now. And I never had any intention of opening El Atoradero. I just saw this beautiful space that was very cheap. And, you know, I was like, this is a perfect place for a restaurant. And we had a couple of things that we were kind of kicking around, and everything was falling through. And at that same time, my partner now, Chef Denise, she had this, her restaurant was in the Bronx, and I was like, this is the best Mexican restaurant in the city. I was like, I love this place. You know, I had written about it for Real Cheap Eats, which was the website that I used to run. A lot of other people had started writing about her. She was in the New York Times, and her lease was about to be up, and she didn't want to resign the lease because her landlord wanted to raise the rent. So she sold her business before even thinking about it. And then she was like, oh, I need to open a restaurant. And I called her up. I was like, let's do this. This is the perfect place for you. And now we are partners. It's a, you know, it's kind of an interesting dynamic.
And so you're a white Jewish guy from Cincinnati. You partner up with a Chinese guy from Queens to do a South Carolina whole hog barbecue. And then you partner up with a woman from the Bronx, Denise Lina Chavez, to reopen her Mexican restaurant in Prospect Heights. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like, from a... People these days are discussing cultural appropriation. It's something that is always at the tip of everyone's tongue. Is that something that you've thought about, that you deal with in your restaurants? Do people come in and say, like, hey, you're a white guy, like, you shouldn't be doing this type of food? Is that something that you've come up against in opening up these restaurants? Is it something that has affected any decisions that you've made?
It was definitely initially, like, more of a concern than I think it is now. Now we've been open almost 2 years, and it's kind of grown into what it is, I guess. But when we were opening, you know, it was interesting because, excuse me, my chef wanted to open what you would think of when you think of, like, kind of, I hate to say this, like a cheesy Mexican restaurant. So, you know, like the chili, like not chili lights, but, like, you know, she had this thing where it was like a drunk Mexican guy out front holding a sign that said, you know, come eat tacos, like 2-for-1 cervezas. And we were like, how would this look with, you know, us, you know, some people come in and they see me standing in front? Like, I don't think that was going to be a good look. So, you know, we did have this conversation, and, you know, we did settle on trying to kind of meld the two. I don't know how successful in terms of, like, it looks in terms of melding the two, but the core concept of the restaurant was to put, you know, chefs cooking in, you know, a more, like, approachable space, something that's more, like, not plain, but, like, not something that you walk into and say, oh, that's a Mexican restaurant right away. Mm-hmm. I think it's been successful. It's still interesting to see, you know, people kind of come in and expect, you know, an entirely Mexican staff. And we do have mostly a Mexican staff, and, you know, everybody speaks Spanish. My Spanish is vastly improved. I mean, I guess I'm fluent in kitchen Spanish. I know all the food words. Mm-hmm. I know how to tell somebody to do something. But yeah, it's been tough, but it's been easier than I thought. You know, at first it was definitely much more of a concern than it is now. It's just kind of, you know, like I said, we've kind of grown into it, and we are what we are now. And people, you know, we're a known quantity, and people kind of accept us for what we're doing.
I want to know about going from lawyer to sort of investor partner to really full-on operational running of the restaurant, because whenever I go to your restaurant, El Tordero, I see you there. Mm-hmm. And I know that you spend a lot of time there. You're not just a quiet owner or a quiet investor. How has your life changed in the 2 years that El Tordero has opened and that you've really put yourself on the ground in the restaurant every single day? Like, do you consider yourself like a hybrid owner, general manager? Is that how you see yourself?
Yes. It's different than working 14-hour days, pretty much 6 days a week. It's exhausting. It's, you know, it's tough on trying to find some time to get away. It's been very interesting that, you know, there's certain areas that I've kind of grown into naturally in terms of operating the restaurant, like anything that's like legal or regulatory. I have a handle on. Because of my background as a writer, like anything with like press and marketing, like I feel comfortable doing. But then it's, you know, coming at this sideways, like I was saying, you know, I can handle, you know, if I, you know, it, when we first opened, like we'd be short staffed. I'd be down in the kitchen doing prep for 4 hours in the morning, like cutting onions and cilantro and tomatoes. I still kind of feel a little like I'm a foreigner in a kitchen, or, you know, in terms of managing staff, all of a sudden I'm the GM and I'm supposed to know how to train staff, how to manage staff every day. It's definitely been like a steep learning curve, but, it's been 2 years now and I'm getting there. There's definitely stuff that I enjoy doing much more than others.
And you're still open, so.
And we're still open. We haven't closed yet. We're not bankrupt.
Something's happening.
Yeah, knock on wood. Knock on the cedar. I think it's going well. It's where we are now is an interesting place, because now we're kind of a mature restaurant. It's like, where do we go from here? How do we take it to the next level? And, you know, am I that person who can, you know, doing everything that I'm doing right now, am I that person who can help it take, who can help take it to the next level? Or does it make sense to kind of take a step back and, you know, find somebody, you know, internally or externally who can help us kind of grow into more of what we are and what we want to be?
And so what you're kind of alluding to right now is that you're at the cusp of becoming sort of like a restaurant group, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the home base, the flagship. Mm-hmm. You've got the taqueria in Gowanus that we can talk about in a second. And then you've got a mezcal bar that's adjacent to El Tordero. And then you also have a spot in Manhattan, correct? That you are
involved in? I'm no longer involved in the spot in Manhattan.
Okay.
But, you know, I helped open that last year, and it was a great experience. And, you know, we kind of decided that it would make more sense for some of us to be in Brooklyn and some of us to be in Manhattan.
But still with three spots in Brooklyn,
it's definitely
a lot going on. So when you say, like, maybe having someone else mm-hmm. come in, what does that mean? Does that mean that you bring on like a CFO or something like that from a restaurant organizational perspective, and being an owner, relinquishing mm-hmm. control at the right or the wrong time is a very tough decision.
Oh, extremely. Yes. It's really interesting to see us on that cusp, because we opened the taqueria, like you were just alluding to, about 2 months ago. It's doing very well. And it seems to be the model that is going to work for us in the future. You know, there's a lot to be said about the restaurant, but you own Sumesa, the type of model that you have is so much more streamlined. There's so much less.
Yeah. It's fast casual.
I love it.
Order at the counter. I'm like, it's a takeout joint.
Yeah. My partners and I are like, why would we ever open a restaurant again when we can do fast casual like this and serve, you know, the same, if not better quality and quicker, and just, you know, feed more people with us having less overhead.
Yeah.
And less, just, you know, not even just less overhead, but less, you know, there's just so much less stuff that can go wrong. I mean, there's still the obvious stuff, but just, you know, literally the transaction happens and all your responsibility after that is to keep the space clean and make sure the food comes out on time. So, you know, we're going to start exploring more taquerias. And at that point, a CFO makes a lot of sense. Somebody who can manage operations on a day-to-day basis and, you know, free us up to kind of think more big picture would be a great position to be in. We're like not there yet, but we're getting, we can kind of see the light, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a time for a while where it's like, you know, that daily grind where it's like, what are we working for? You know, we're doing well, but, you know, it's still very hard, and it's still hard to see what the end goal is. I mean, you can kind of get lost. I feel like one of the things that I try and avoid, and that it's so hard to avoid, I'm sure you understand this as well, is it's so easy to get lost in that daily kind of grind of restaurants where, you know, you're just kind of focusing on making sure that day is perfect without being able to take a step back and see where you're going. And, you know, to me, I've always been somebody who wants to kind of take a step back and think more big picture, that, you know, it's cool to be able to kind of be like, okay, now we can figure out where we're going, where we want to be, who we want to be. And, yeah, it's exciting.
Take us through what, I know there isn't a normal day, but for those listening, I'm always super curious, people that own more than one space, mm-hmm. specifically, like, what does your day look like from start to finish? If there is something that kind of, if you can make up like a fake week and consolidate it into a day, I want to know, like, how do you start and how do you finish a day if there is such a thing as that?
So I live in Williamsburg, but I actually usually start my day in court in the Bronx. So I, you know, like I said, I'm still practicing. So I'll be in a suit and tie, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, ready to go, driving up to, you know, my fiance works for Fresh Direct. So I drop her at Fresh Direct. I drive now, which is, you know, hugely beneficial and also gives me so much more responsibility at the restaurant because I'm essentially our delivery driver too. So a normal day would be driving to the Bronx, going to court. I'm out of court by like 11 o'clock. Sometimes I'll drive back in and I'll have to go to Jetro or Restaurant Depot or pick something up for the restaurant. If that doesn't happen, we do a lot of office lunch catering now. So like sometimes I have to be that guy who's, you know, in a midtown office, kind of pushing like an insulated box through there. I'm like, I kind of went to law school and now this is what I'm doing. I delivered to one of my old office buildings like a few months ago. I was like, I hope nobody sees me in here. They're gonna have a lot of questions.
It's a weird feeling. Yeah. I find myself in freight elevators quite a bit, being like, all right,
this is where
I
ended up.
This is what I'm doing now.
So there'll be a delivery that happens. After the delivery, sometimes I'll like to like kind of get lunch or something and take like an hour for myself. I'm usually answering phone calls from staff or, you know, placing orders for the next day. I'll get to the restaurant typically around 1-2 o'clock. I'll have at 1-2, like it's normally sort of quiet. There'll be kitchen staff there cooking, but I can kind of like work from the mezcal bar, which is right next door to the restaurant. Yeah, that's usually my most productive time of day, which means I'm answering emails, making phone calls, just trying to catch up for what I'm behind on. Mm-hmm. By 4 o'clock, you know, the bar is open, all the rest of the staff is in. We have every day, so the taqueria is only a mile from the restaurant, but that means, you know, myself or chef are the only two people who have cars. So if the prep has to get loaded up and go to the taqueria, it's either me or chef who's got to take it over there. So I'll typically take the prep to the taqueria. I'll make sure everything's good there. We'll get open. I'll talk to, you know, sometimes the space that we're at has a lot of events. So we'll kind of coordinate whether there's an event tonight, whether we need to have extra prep done. Then I run back to the restaurant. I'll be, you know, like sometimes I get to taste the mezcal, which will be nice. Like we'll have, you know, like a distributor in, we'll have maybe a producer in or importer. So we'll, you know, we get to talk mezcal for a little bit. That's usually maybe the most fun part of the day. And then my evenings will generally be me bouncing between the taqueria and the restaurant, driving back and forth. Sometimes I'll have to go to Staples in between. Sometimes I'll have to go to like PC Richard and Son or, you know, grab something, anything that kind of has to, any kind of dumb job that has to like get done, you know, that'll happen. If I can get like an hour in the office down in the basement, you know, work some stuff out, then I will. But then it's just, you know, looking at the next day, what do we have? Do we have to deliver stuff the next day? Do I have to pick up more stuff at Jetro? You know, like I'm saying, it's kind of gets, you kind of get stuck in this pattern where you're like only worried about that day and next day. And it's hard to be like, okay, let's sit down and plan what we're going to be doing, you know, 1-2 months, 3 months, 6 months from now, like, you know. But the, you know, and then the day last night ended at lately the bar has been busy later than earlier, so it'll be like 11:30 and we're kind of ready to like start doing last call. Then we'll have like 15-20 people to come in and we'll be like happy, you know, do that feeling. It's like you're happy but you're also like, Yeah, so
I kind of want to go to bed, but yeah. I also want your
like
money.
Money. You know, it would be nice to send my guys home with some money tonight. You know, it was a Monday night last night, right after the holidays, but still kind of coming back. So we're happy to have it. And I got home at like 2 o'clock last night, so now up early, ready to go.
Well, we're going to let you take a breath after that day, and we're going to take a breather as well. We'll be right back after this message.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Line. I'm here with Noah Ehrenstein. He is the owner of El Atoradero in Brooklyn, Madre Mezcaleria, and Taqueria El Atoradero in Gowanus. He's also one of the founders of Real Cheap Eats, which was a website that basically was trying to find the best food in New York City for cheap. And he's written a bunch all about food all over the internet. We were talking about your crazy day right before we took a break, and now I want to jump way back because you're from Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that your family, you came from a family of lawyers, but you've also got a little bit of food history.
Sure.
In your family as well. So tell me a little bit about growing up in Cincinnati and what kind of family food influence constructed your view of food when you were younger.
We were like a tight Jewish family. My mother's parents were like, you know, what's the word? Epicureans, I guess. Not even so, but like my grandmother was like an amazing cook. She could bake like mandelbread, that would like stuff like that, like the like classic Jewish baking that you know, classic Jewish Eastern European baking that you think of. So like I grew up eating that, and my grandfather, his family were fishmongers, and he could, you know, but he loved like, you know, his favorite in the world was like, you know, being able to find that perfect cantaloupe or perfect honeydew, and he knew exactly how to pick it. It was like so fun to like kind of watch him do that. And he pickled watermelons we grew up eating, pickled tomatoes, and then just pickles. And, you know, one of the clearest memories I have too is those Hebrew National beef salamis. I love those still, but like he would hang them to dry over his counter. And so once they got super, super dry, he would like take like this like super sharp little knife and we just cut off little pieces and give us pieces of that dried salami. And it's just like such a vivid memory of like, you know, of that taste, that concentrated like beef salami flavor. Cincinnati was interesting to grow up in. I mean, I don't think it was really known for its food. You know, people know it for like Cincinnati chili. That's like the big thing, like chili over spaghetti.
Such a weird thing.
I know, right? You have Coney's in Michigan, But like, you know, they had conies, but like the thing was the spaghetti, the three ways, the four ways, the five ways.
Wait, slow down. Okay, I'm happy that you brought that up.
I can talk about it.
Take us through the 3, 4, 5. This is something that I heard about from one of the guys who taught me a lot of stuff from Mile End, who's from Cincinnati. And for those people that don't know, in Cincinnati, there is this you can get it everywhere, right?
So I guess it's like, so the people who originally made it were like Macedonian and Greek immigrants. So they kind of made that, when you think of the beef chili, it's not really chili. Because when you say chili, everybody's like, this doesn't taste like chili. It almost tastes like, what's the dish?
Like Sloppy Joe's?
Not even Sloppy Joe. It's spiced. It's spiced so specifically. It's almost that dish.
Like goulash?
Not goulash. What's the Greek dish with like the bechamel and the meat?
Oh, moussaka?
But that has eggplant, right?
It's kind of spiced, and bechamel, yeah. And
the ground meat, it's kind of spiced that same way. So it's got like a lot of warming spices. And chocolate is kind of known to be in it, but that's maybe not actually in it. Yeah, there's a lot of like mist. Like I was looking at
now
like
we're in like the mole realm or something. It's like that.
It's like the mole of Cincinnati. Yeah, it's maybe giving it too much credit. So a three way would be spaghetti, like a very, you don't even think of al dente. It's like really cooked through spaghetti. Then like the chili, but you can get the chili dry if you want. But like all the flavors in the juice. My brother still ordered dry, but the flavors in the juice. Mm-hmm. So then cheese on top, and it's not just like a little bit of cheese. It's like this, you know, fluorescent cheddar, and it's like a whole mound on top of the plate. So it's humongous. So a four way would then be either onions or beans. Five way would be both. Some places do a six way where it adds like fried jalapenos on top or whatever else you want. And it's just this like, you know, it's kind of like garbage plates in Rochester or like, you know, Coney's elsewhere.
It sounds like what, like
just
a,
like good drunk food.
Like a high 14-year-old or like a drunk freshman in college would be like, I found all this stuff in the fridge and I put it in a bowl and it's good. Yeah. And so like, is that a quote unquote, is that like the working man's meal in Cincinnati? Or is it like, how do you know how it came to be? It seems just like kind of a weird, gross thing to put
all of
that stuff on spaghetti.
I guess. Well, like I said, Macedonian and Greek, and that's like the big immigration that kind of happened in Cincinnati early in the right around World War I. Mm-hmm. So I guess they were kind of trying to see, they were like, oh, let's, you know, it was almost like they were trying to be, you know, those places where it's like an Italian restaurant run by like Albanians or something like that. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like they were trying to kind of, you know, recreate that, like, oh, we had, you know, pasta and meat sauce and cheese. That's what people, that's what Americans like to eat, right? And then people in Cincinnati are like, yeah, this is delicious. Let's
It's like from three different verticals, though. It's like the cheese is wrong and the meat sauce is wrong and the spaghetti's really overcooked, but it's like, it works together.
It's like if you ran it through you know, where they run stuff through a translator and they translate it back into English and it doesn't make any sense. But then I'm like, we're like, oh, it's drunk food, but then now I'm like, oh, but this was all created during Prohibition, so I don't even know what's going on anymore.
And people definitely obviously eat it for lunch. They're not only eating it at, you know, 2 a.m. or something like that.
No, everybody in Cincinnati is really walking around with chili in their pants. It's kind of gross.
So you're in the Midwest. You've got, you know, chili in your belly and your grandpa's making all these pickles and stuff. Do you have any general interest in food really like – pursuing that as a career when you were younger, or is that something that really came about much later when you were in New York City?
I think as a career, it came about much later, almost for lack of options and trying to think what I was potentially good at and what I could really pursue. I taught myself how to cook in law school, you know, where it was basically I'm studying all day and it's like I needed an outlet. And I was working in New York City at the time, but I went to law school in Macon, Georgia, like about an hour south of Atlanta. So like, I could make New York City money in Macon, Georgia, where, you know, a couple hours I'd pay the rent. And it was like, we had this extra money. I was like, let's learn how to cook. And I'm like cooking, you know, so I could get like, we could get like nice steaks. I got like leg of lamb and like, we could get like all this nice stuff. And I could spend some time, you know, cooking and like, you know, teaching myself. So, I got to be a pretty good home cook. And then I came to New York and, you know, I knew I had this writing background as well from being a lawyer. And, you know, there was just like, I don't know what really kind of,
you know, pushed it. Maybe it was in Atlanta, growing, being in Atlanta a lot along Buford Highway, which has this like amazing food scene where it's this great mix between like Korean and Vietnamese and Latino and, you know, all these like combination of cultures and foods like on this one area. And we just explore it and be like, this is amazing. And, you know, I moved to New York. And I was like, I want to keep eating stuff like this. So like, you know, Real Cheap Eats kind of came about with my partner James, who, you know, was writing about this sort of stuff too. We wanted to just, you know, there's so much stuff in New York City that was not explored that we wanted to be able to like taste it all and kind of bring it all to people's, you know, let people find out about it. So like, and it's crazy because that's how I met Jeff. That's how I met my partner through, we were kind of messing around the Bronx, like looking
just
at places.
Exploring New York, kind of.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you some really hard questions. This is a speed round, okay? Favorite dish in all of New York City?
That's tough. Favorite dish in all of New York City? I mean, I guess I like burgers a lot. Hard Time Sundays burger is really, really good.
Okay. Favorite sandwich in all of New York City? Under $20.
$20?
Yeah.
Well, what would be a good over $20 sandwich? I don't even know. you know, lately...
I was hoping to box out the fancy like burger, but you already... Yeah,
yeah. Lately, is a Euro a sandwich? Are we sure. Going through? Lately, this place, Kebab Shack on Havemeyer.
Oh, Kebab Shack is good.
I love that place. Like, it's... I could talk about Kebab Shack for a while, but that place is single dude central. It's always like... guys by themselves in there on their phones,
their phone. Yeah.
Just like ready to eat, like ready to like crush one of those sandwiches.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, I'm in the same biz as them. Yeah. But they're farther enough away, I think, that we have, you know, how there's like micro clientele.
They're not super efficient. You guys are much more efficient than they are.
Yeah, their flavor is good.
The flavor's
good. I definitely like them a lot. I used to spend a lot of time on Havermeyer and eat there. Okay, last question. Favorite restaurant now?
Uh-huh.
And what was your favorite restaurant when you originally were doing Real Cheap Eats? Have they changed?
That's a good question. My favorite restaurant when we were originally doing Real Cheap Eats, they were probably a little more esoteric than they are now because I just don't have time to like go to some of those places anymore. So Uncle Joe, this place in Elmhurst where it's like Northern Chinese food, you know, they had this fried rabbit dish that was just so good. It was like the Chongqing rabbit, basically, where it's like the little pieces of rabbit. You can just like pick at it forever. And then it had like that warming lamb soup. And there was a place in the Golden Shopping Mall in Flushing, a Szechuan place that was just like one of my favorites. You know, they did like a cold salad that was just like spicy and crunchy and had every element you could ever want. Favorite restaurant now. See, like I say, I'm so busy. I kind of go to my friends' places. So I go to like, I go to Emily a lot, Emmy Squared. Like those are kind of the places that I hit up.
You go there so much that what happens?
Yeah, I have a pizza named after me at the West Village one.
So you only have to go 100 times to a restaurant?
Yeah,
and
only 100 times.
Name a pizza.
I only have to go 100 times, order a pizza in a very specific way, and then I'll get it.
What's your pizza at Emily, which is like a pretty big honor, let's be honest.
It's cool. That's kind of crazy. Because yes. I'm seeing like people like hashtag Ehrenstein, and it'll like pop up on my... I'm like, what is going on? It's a square vodka pie with pepperoni, pickled jalapenos, and honey. It's really nice.
Cool.
I like vodka pies.
And so they had like a create your own option and you kept ordering it over and over?
So they have a pie called the Colony, which is the same toppings and everything but regular sauce. And I would always get a vodka Colony. And so the vodka Colony became the Ehrenstein.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Everybody, that's like the Seinfeld dream, right?
I know, right?
Like, move to New York and you're like, I have a food item named after me.
Yeah, I need to get like in a deli net. The next step would be to get like a deli sandwich named after me.
Oh my God, like at Second Avenue Deli or something like that.
Cool.
You could die a happy man at that point. I want to know, do you have any other projects in the works? You've got the Taqueria, which is fairly new, and the Mezcal spot that are also pretty new, but are you working on anything else right now?
There's some stuff in the works actually nearby here, but nothing I can really like go in depth about. I was kind of telling you about that tableau we were talking about where it's almost like a float. Like,
so before we went on air, you were telling me about go ahead.
Like that natural history museum kind of tableau look. We kind of want to do a bar that's like Florida themed and has that look to it, but with like Florida flora and fauna kind of around, like a central kind of alligator gator type bar. So
Sounds wild. We're
kind of looking at spots for that. It would be kind of something different, you know.
I want to before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit more about just kind of being the transition from mm-hmm. becoming, you know, a lawyer really into a hybrid sort of lawyer restaurateur. Who did you really look to for advice as you were starting to work on these projects? Was there someone specific on the food side or on the ownership side, like a chef or someone who was more like, yeah, I own a bunch of restaurants, that you leaned on for advice in getting your spots open?
That's interesting. I mean, there's a couple, there was never really anybody. I was kind of always on my own on the legal side, which was, you know, good in a lot of ways. And, you know, nothing, you know, everything was kind of easy to figure out there. It was always on the restaurant side where I was like kind of looking for a mentorship, looking for somebody who could kind of, you know, give me some guidance. You know, somebody who comes to mind who was not, you know, I think if I told him this now, he'd be like, no, that wasn't me at all. But somebody who I kind of always like looked up to as like a really good example of like who I want to be in this industry would be Matt Fisher from Fletcher's. He just, you know, he's kind of one of those guys who like always gives good advice. Like if I kind of had like an issue, if I just wanted to like talk something out, I kind of, you know, he'd be a good person to talk to. Who else, you know? Yeah, Matt was probably the guy who kind of came to mind earliest. I mean, I always kind of, you know, it was interesting too. You know, Noah Berminoff was somebody who I kind of looked up to in general, just as somebody who, you know, kind of did that same transition that, you know, I'm doing now. He was in law school.
He was in law school when he decided to. Yeah,
I remember when I had just graduated from law school too when he opened Mile End, and I remember seeing that and be like, damn, that's what I want to do. You know, so that was kind of, you know, more of like a distant inspiration was Noah, but yeah, Matt Fisher kind of. He's just a good guy to talk to whenever you need like some real advice, some sage advice. You know, that's kind of like the type of person I want to be in the industry.
What's the most frustrating part about doing what you do?
I almost said POS systems. what's the most frustrating part? I think like what I've kind of been you know, talking about before is like trying to get yourself out of that daily grind and being able to like think smartly and strategically about what your restaurant is and where it's going, because, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in it that you really don't, you kind of spin your wheels. And, you know, I kind of think of that shark metaphor from like the Woody Allen movies where you're like, you have to be moving forward or you're dead. You know, you want to keep pushing it forward. And to like, you know, for me to kind of see, you know, when I see us kind of stagnating, that's when I get the most frustrated. Like, I want to keep pushing it forward. Like, that's, you know, that's where we need to be.
So what's the moment that's been the most satisfying for you from your culinary journey from Scharfenzoyer to now having these various, you know, Mexican establishments? What's been the most satisfying moment?
I can't say the pizza being named after me. That would be the most like temporarily satisfying. You know, really just kind of seeing what we built at El Tordero, seeing it grow, seeing Chef kind of grow into this new role for her where she was before, you know, just kind of running almost like a little takeout counter, to now we have, you know, having three places and wanting to do more and kind of, you know, growing with her family. You know, getting to know everybody in her family, getting to know, you know, that's just the diverse group of people who work with us. It's very satisfying to kind of all be on this same team, kind of working towards a similar goal. And it's just been really, you know, that's what feels good. Like, you know, feeding, you know, seeing somebody, you know, try a mezcal that they've never tried before, like being able to talk to them about, you know, teaching them about mezcal and basically being like, you know, try this, it'll blow your mind. And seeing somebody's eyes like light up, oh my God, I've never had anything like that before. Or the same with like, you know, having people try Chef's Mole, where it's like something, you know, something so familiar yet so new. It's so satisfying to see.
That mole is no joke. I can say firsthand. That is something that I think about all the time. Let everyone know where they can find your spots and when are you open at your various restaurants?
Oh, so El Tordero is on 708 Washington in Prospect Heights at St. Mark's. The Madre Mezcaleria is right next door. A Tordero is open just for dinner right now, but we're actually planning on opening all day in the next couple weeks,
cool.
which would be like a big change for us. The Mezcal Bar is open 4 till, you know, everybody leaves. and then the Taqueria is at this amazing venue called Park Life, which is across in Gowanus. It's across from Littlefield, which is like a great like little venue for like comedy shows, and you know, they do like reggae nights, and they do like a lot of people know that show Punderdome. They do that show. So we're this big like 6,000 square foot outdoor space with like a little kitchen, and we're just like pumping out tacos there. It's just it's so much fun. We get to like do exactly what we want. Like I went to this little taqueria in Mexico City that served French fries on top of tacos and called themselves McTios with like big golden arches. And we were like, French fries on top of tacos. That's amazing. We want to do that here. And you know, it's just that little taqueria is kind of everything that we want to be serving people right now.
Cool. Noah, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. We hope to see you next week, every Tuesday, 11 a.m. for The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.